people think about the period that, you know, my talk kind of covers, it's situated in the 60s and 70s, I guess one of the images that comes to mind is, you know, an image of a period of struggle, and particularly student revolt.
Yeah, we've got a struggle
to get into the room. And, you know, particularly student revolt. And all across the world, it's true at this time, there were struggles led by students who were incensed by the real barbarity of the Vietnam War, the napalming of whole villages, but yet inspired by the Vietnamese resistance to the US war machine. So in countries like France, students and workers almost brought the, you know, right-wing de Gaulle regime to a complete standstill in May 1968. You know, Mexican students took to the streets in protests against their government and the Olympics, and there was, you know, obviously the explosion and radicalisation of students on campuses in the United States. And from 67 to 1968, Italian students actually launched their own struggle, which was to be one of the largest and most radical in the world. And I guess that, you know, one of the points that I want to really draw out in the talk is about the connection that the Italian students were able to make to the working class. Because in France, students had, you know, linked up with workers who had staffed the barricades alongside them in May 68. But in Italy, it was the case that the student revolutionaries achieved a real connection with the workers, that, you know, kind of connection that their French counterparts had only dreamt of. The student movement that had broken out at universities all across Italy in 1967 intersected with a radicalisation of the Italian working class, which from 1968 moved into a struggle of near-revolutionary proportions. And there were, you know, just to give you a sense of this, there are 1 million workers who participated in a general strike in November of 1969. And, you know, in that year alone, workers were on strike for more than 300,000 hours. So, you know, that gives you some sense of you know, the depth of the struggle. And this struggle was inspiring not just because, you know, Italian students and workers managed to take a joint stand against capitalism, but it's also a really instructive struggle for us in a revolutionary organisation, Socialist Alternative Today, and trying to build an organisation. Because it was in the course of this struggle that left groups that had initially been small groups, you know, with their main sphere of influence on the campuses, not in the working class, that were actually able to relate to the upsurge in workers' struggle and in so doing break through and build sizable organisations of tens of thousands of members with a real base in the working class. And these were groups which, as I said, led huge strikes, they put out daily papers and even ran their own radio stations. But, you know, the point of my talk is not just to give a kind of glowing, hopefully a glowing and inspiring account of what happened in Italy in this period, but also to draw out some of the lessons from the experience of the revolutionary left in this period. So I think that the, you know, important question to start with is, how did this happen? How did, you know, the revolutionary left manage to attain such influence? And to answer that, I kind of want to look first to the student movement, which laid a bit of a basis for their later growth in amongst workers. The Italian students were obviously influenced by international phenomena and the things that were happening in the world in 1968, but their revolt was also based firmly in the material conditions of an Italian capitalism that was really trying to bring itself forward to compete with more advanced capitalist countries in this period. So in the 50s and 60s, there'd been Italian capitalism had experienced an economic boom. And in the space of a few years, a country that had been mostly agricultural was turned into, you know, an industrial nation. And the development of Italian capitalism obviously required, you know, a more skilled workforce. And this led to the opening up of the universities, and student numbers almost doubled in a short period of time, from, you know, some 250,000 in 1960 to about, you know, approaching 500,000 in 1968. And the bulk of these new students came from the middle class, you know, middle class families, but for the first time, a limited number of workers were actually able to enrol in university. And the decision to allow open access to university education wasn't accompanied by an increase, though, in any of the facilities that had existed on the campuses. There were too few staff to go around, classes were overcrowded, and in addition, while most of the students, you know, weren't from a working class background, the fact that there were no government grants on offer to, you know, help students pay the costs of their study meant that a lot of them had to work lots of hours to be able to pay for their education. And, you know, even if students were able to get over all of those trials, getting a degree still didn't guarantee you a very high-status job once you graduated. And this will be familiar to anyone here who's a student. We're experiencing the same kind of thing. And the first of the student protests really began at the University of Trento in 1967. But by February in 68, the student movement had spread out to most universities and even some of the secondary schools. And students not only took a stance against the conditions in the education system, but actually began to turn their attention to critiquing capitalist society and its institutions more broadly. And the student radicalisation really transformed the political climate on campuses. So students at Trento and Turin challenged the authority of their professors by interrupting their lectures and forcing them to confront the issues that were being debated in student assemblies, which were, you know, set up to discuss the struggle and to allow the mass of students to participate in decision-making processes about that struggle and political debate. And as the students' ideas changed and they became more politicised, they also began to change, you know, even some of the things that we might think of as more mundane things, like, you know, the way they dressed. And the historian Paul Ginsborg explained that there was a real change in atmosphere in what was an essentially socially conservative country where the Christian Democrat right had been in power since the end of the World War. And he writes, "In Milan, in the area around the State University, graffiti appeared everywhere and on everything. Students changed the way they looked. The men grew their hair and abandoned jackets, ties and sombre-coloured clothes in favour of jeans, beards and red handkerchiefs tied around their neck. The women gave up makeup, dresses and high heels in favour of trousers, jeans, pullovers and boots." The students were really drawn towards Marxist ideas, because they found that Marxism could provide some explanation both for the impact of the rapid economic development in Italy at the time, and how that was playing out on students and workers, as well as an analysis of the role of the education system as a way of, you know, shaping a layer of subordinate workers that would be well-versed in the values of capitalist competition that were so vital for, the advance of Italian industry at that time. The student movement was the movement that really laid the basis for the emergence and growth of new left groups outside of the Italian Communist Party, the PCI, which was, a mass party. It had 1.5 million members and had extensive roots in Italian society through trade unions and its links to them, but also through, numerous other cultural and youth groups and so on. But by this time, it's important for us to understand the Communist Party had lost its revolutionary politics. It was firmly a reformist party oriented towards winning influence in Parliament. So what kind of groups emerged of the revolutionary left? Well, there were three main revolutionary groups that were forged out of the student struggle. Avanguardia Operaia, or Workers' Vanguard, which originated out of the student movement in Milan. Potere Operaia, Workers' Power, which gained influence around Turin, and the group which was to go on to become the biggest of the revolutionary organisations, Lotta Continua. And there were some political differences between the three groups, but they were all influenced to varying degrees by Stalinist politics. So on one hand, the new revolutionary left in Italy, these groups rejected Stalinist Russia as an example of socialism. You know, it was clearly an authoritarian regime of capitalist competition where workers were exploited, you know, akin to the conditions that workers faced in Western capitalist countries. And this led the revolutionaries to break with the Stalinist Italian Communist Party. But importantly, they didn't make a clean break with Stalinist politics. They merely looked to what at the time appeared to be a more radical form of it in the Chinese Revolution and Maoism. Now, I don't have time tonight to go over all of the, you know, contradictions of communist China in detail. If people have questions, they can flesh them out in the discussion. But suffice it to say that Mao's China, where revolution had been made not by the mass of the organised working class, but by a, you know, band of armed intellectuals, had nothing to do with revolutionary socialism, which is about the working class actually struggling for their own liberation, in the course of doing that, taking control of their own lives and of society. And in Italy in these years, the real problem was that there was not even a small revolutionary group, not even a group of socialist alternative size that had genuine revolutionary Marxist politics, the kind of politics that we stand for and we're proud to stand for in our socialist alternative. And it was really with the explosion of workers' struggles that these revolutionary groups, at first comprised of mainly, student militants, were to become the largest revolutionary organisations in Europe, mobilising tens of thousands of students of workers in mass struggle. So, as I alluded to, the advance of Italian capitalism hadn't just affected the conditions of students in the universities. The student movement, as I said, intersected with a growing radicalisation of the Italian working class, which was reacting against the increased exploitation of workers. Because making Italian capitalism more competitive actually meant increasing the productivity of Italian industry. And this translated into the speeding up of production lines in factories, the de-skilling of jobs, which in turn led to differences in pay between lower-skilled and more-skilled workers, and workers being forced to do an enormous amount of unpaid overtime. And just to give you some sense of the pressures that workers were under at the time, an article which I really like the name of, entitled Spontaneous Reflections of a Woman Worker, that was published in 1969, angrily declared, "Those who do overtime often say that there is nothing left to life but work." And this just shows how thoroughly we've been brutalised by the bosses. And apart from the expectation that workers would work harder and for longer, Italian capitalism had also made its advance on the back of lowering wages for workers. And this was just the beginning of the problems that the Italian working class confronted, because the development of industry had also led to, a mass immigration of people from the agricultural south into the cities in the north, where they could find work. But a lack of infrastructure meant that when they got there, there was, almost no options in terms of decent, affordable housing that they could get. And it was in this context of, advancing capitalist competition in Italy that workers' struggle really took off in 1968. When workers started to go on strike around their own demands, the student revolutionaries saw the need to carry their ideas to the workers and to convince them of the need to oppose the whole of the capitalist system. And although, workers had had some, industrial action in the earlier 60s, there was a real escalation in workers' struggle in 1967 as the rubber workers' contract came up for renewal. The trade unions organised strikes to support the workers' claims for a wage increase, but eventually they settled with the bosses for a new contract which guaranteed almost no improvements in the wages or conditions of workers. But the workers refused to accept the new contract and they continued to strike in protest. And it was then that students, student revolutionaries and militants joined workers' rallies at the gates of the Pirelli rubber factory, where they were pretty well received. By June 1969, the Pirelli workers and, the revolutionaries of workers' vanguard, with mainly student members, had organised the United Base Committee, or CUB, to continue the struggle. The CUB raised workers' demands of slowing down the assembly line, pay parity between white and blue-collar workers, and workers' control of the conditions and safety in their workplaces, in their factories. And it was able to actually win significant reforms and became a model for many other such committees in Milan. A lot of the work... I'll take a drink and pause so you can think on that. A lot of the work that we do in socialist alternative today is amongst students. So one of the things that people often say to us is, or a question that people have is, why would workers who are organised into their own trade unions think that a revolutionary group like yours has anything really to offer their struggles? And the experience of the Italian revolutionaries showed that in an upsurge of workers' struggle, the ideas and arguments of the revolutionary left groups can have a hold regardless of whether or not they've previously had, a base in the working class or on the campuses or whatever. And the Italian revolutionaries were able to gain real influence with the Pirelli workers and later in factories all around the country. And this was, the case despite the fact that in Italy at that time there was a greater gap between, the lifestyles of the students and workers than exists in Australia today, where, most students, some 80%, are workers too. After the events at the Pirelli factory, workers' struggle spread in what the right quickly dubbed the Hot Autumn. And obviously, just as quickly, the left appropriated this as a pretty good description of what they set out to achieve in terms of their struggle. And the climax of the period came with the events at the huge Fiat Miafori plant in Turin in the summer of 1969. In May and June, workers at the plant led a series of strikes for better conditions. And the revolutionaries called for a student worker assembly in Turin to be able to coordinate the protest. The positive response from workers who flocked to the university to attend the meetings, which were held in a lecture theatre, as one of the medicine lecture theatres, at the end of every shift, summed up, stunned, really, those who were sceptical of the revolutionaries being able to connect with workers and have some influence amongst them. And one such sceptic wrote, "The unbelievable happened. The student movement called for a general assembly of workers at the university, and they came in their hundreds. The hall was full, packed. It was amazing. And they didn't only pack the hall, they took the microphone and spoke about their living conditions. 'We've had enough,' they said. 'We live in miserable conditions. We support what you're doing. You students are right.'" And it was clear that the workers had, obviously admired the students for also taking a stand and having fought around their own demands on the campuses. The revolutionary group Lotta Continua grew by the thousands out of the assemblies in Turin, putting out daily bulletins advertising the Fiat workers' demands. And by the end of May, the bulletins started to come out with the heading Lotta Continua. And by June, the Workers' Student Assembly met every Saturday to discuss the content of Lotta Continua's paper, which had a weekly print run of 65,000 by November. Workers booked whole railway carriages. Can you imagine what it would be like to book a whole of a railway carriage to attend the assemblies, which were held in different cities every weekend? When the trade unions called a one-day strike against, high rent rate prices in Italy in July under the slogan "No More Rents," Lotta Continua led a huge rally of students and workers from Fiat and other factories in Turin with its own slogan of "Cecos vogliamo tutto," and for everyone who doesn't speak Italian, and that's probably most of you, that means "What do we want? Everything." And this slogan, this slogan really gives you a feel for the sense of hope for real change and, the increased expectations that came from workers who, for the first time, or, for the first time in a long time, were experiencing their power to shut down industry, to exercise some control over their lives, and which the revolutionary left could relate to. The demonstration was followed by mass assemblies involving thousands, not just at Fiat Mirafiori, but also in other factories, as mass struggle for a new contract in the metal workers industry saw a burst of militancy across the whole of Italian industry. And the revolutionaries that had won support at Fiat were able to gain new audiences in different workplaces. During this period, workers forced the government to raise the pension and to implement a workers' charter in 1970, which reflected and guaranteed some of the demands that had been raised in the Hot Autumn, laying down the right to assembly, the right to protection in dangerous jobs, the right to organise trade unions at work, and the right to appeal against unfair dismissal. Pretty much all of those things that we've been discussing over the course of the weekend are actually under attack across the world from the bosses and governments like our own disgusting Howard government here. But it was inevitable that at some point the bosses would move to quell the workers' movement. And in the early 1970s, they moved to cut wages, and the government more forcefully used the police to break up the workers' strikes and rallies. But in the face of this offensive, did the workers lie down and comply? No, you bet you they didn't. They continued to protest in all kinds of ways. And for instance, when the bosses tried to increase prices for a range of services in society, the revolutionary left groups led a campaign called Auto Reduction. So what did that mean? Well, in 1974, workers at the Fiat Rivalta plant refused to pay increased prices for bus tickets to get them to work. And instead, the workers elected bus delegates to actually go around and collect the money from all the workers at the old rate and then send it to the private bus company. And the same happened when the price of electricity was raised and the Electrical Workers' Union refused to cut off supply to anyone who paid for the electricity at a reduced rate. The workers' movement seems, as you can see from these examples, to pose a real challenge to the viability of the whole of Italian capitalism. In 1969, in Milan, there were almost daily street marches. From 68 to 69, the strike rate had increased fourfold in the course of only 1 year. And well into the 70s, the number of hours lost due to strikes for employers was, you know, huge, in the hundreds upon hundreds of thousands. The high level of industrial action was accompanied by a real flourishing of workers' creativity and a real thirst to talk about, politics more broadly and to have a say. So one historian, Robert Lumley, describes how the walls of many factories were plastered literally from wall to from ceiling to floor, rather, with blank posters which workers used to write up their own slogans, their own demands and comments. And he also says that workers also filled up their workplaces with writings, but also artwork and carvings, which began in the toilets and the staff rooms and then pushed over to take over the whole of the factory floor. And the walls outside almost every factory were spray-painted red with political graffiti. From 1969 to 71, in this climate of, you know, intensified class struggle, the revolutionary left groups were able to grow to mass influence, vying for influence with the old trade union structures and the Communist Party, which, you know, often found throughout the course of the struggle that the initiative had really passed out of their hands and into those of the rank and file, worker committees and the revolutionary groups. And the Marxist Chris Harman sums up the ascent of the revolutionary left thus. As workers were drawn into wage struggles, demonstrations, political strikes, occupations, the revolutionaries were often the only section of the left to respond to the possibilities. Suddenly, their leaflets and their papers were being enthusiastically accepted and read by at least some of working class activists. There were occasions when they had only to raise their red banners and thousands would march behind them. It was possible for groups that had built themselves from dozens to hundreds through participation in student struggles to now draw in thousands of workers. And it's estimated that between 68 and the late 70s, more than 100,000 people became members of the far-left organisations in Italy. And the groups, as I said, they put out daily papers, and apart from their membership, they could also count on the support of a periphery of tens of thousands of other workers. But despite the ferment of, you know, workers and student struggle in Italy from the late 60s and through into the 70s, and the considerable influence that the far left groups were able to gain, the revolutionaries were not able to fulfil the potential of, you know, building a lasting movement against capitalism in Italy. And this had everything, absolutely everything to do with those Stalinist politics that they were influenced by that I mentioned earlier. And, you know, I guess to see how their Stalinist influences, the fact that they looked to Maoism as a revolutionary alternative to the Soviet Union, how did this flow through their politics? Well, in the main, their Stalinist kind of tendencies manifested in the form of, you know, ultra-leftism, which was, you know, a tendency to take positions and make arguments that went beyond the actual political climate at the time and, you know, far above the actual ideas that workers and attitudes that workers held. Sectarianism and substitutionism, which, you know, was the idea that something other than or outside of the organised working class could be a force for real revolutionary change. And to understand the implications of these politics on the prospects of the revolutionaries, you have to look really at how the events in Italy unfurled in the 70s. And this is what I'm going to dedicate the rest of my talk to sort of doing a bit. In the upsurge of workers' struggles from 69 to about 71, the revolutionary left was convinced that revolution was pretty imminent. And in those heady days of mass strikes and protests, you could see that there was some basis in the material level, reality of the high level of struggle for, you know, for some hope that revolution could be won. They had thrown themselves into the workers' movement wholeheartedly, but they troubled themselves very little with developing any clear analysis of the nature of Italian capitalism, the strength of the working class, or what could realistically be attained out of their struggles. For a while, as the workers' struggle was moving forward, it didn't really matter so much that they didn't have this clear analysis because they could grow out of just launching themselves into the struggles that were happening around them. But in 1973, The economic boom that had produced the exploitative conditions that the workers were revolting against, but which had also generated enough profits to allow the space for workers to win reforms from the bosses and government, actually that economic boom came to an end. And a number of factories closed down, workers lost their jobs, a lot of multinational companies refused to invest anymore in Italian capitalism because the struggle had actually meant that the trade unions were too strong and the cost of labour really too high for their liking. Whilst workers fought back against the factory closures, it was, by no means something that they just accepted, and they struck in solidarity with retrenched workers, and they even managed in 1975 to win legislation that linked their wages to inflation to protect, the wages of the lowest paid workers. Things in this period were no longer up, up and away for the Italian working class, and it was in this context that the ideas of the revolutionaries were really put to the test. At this time, it was important for them to take stock of the situation confronting the working class, to recognise that they weren't anymore just on the offensive, and they had to knuckle down, importantly, and consolidate the gains that they had made out of the workers' upsurge, and try and build what they could. But instead, their Stalinist influences, underpinned by a strong dose of impatience to see their dream of looming socialist revolution realised, led the revolutionary left to make some truly, truly horrific political mistakes, I think, throughout the course of this period. Their tendency towards ultra-leftism had reared its head early on around the question of what attitude should the revolutionary groups take to the trade unions. When the Communist Party pushed for the trade unions to set up delegate-based factory councils in 1971 to be able to relate to the workers' struggle and run industrial disputes, the revolutionary left groups adopted the sectarian attitude of denouncing the committees for being part of the existing Communist Party and union structures which had sold out workers' struggles. So a lot of Continua devoted a whole edition of their paper to slagging off the factory committees as instruments of counter-revolutionary control of the masses, and they raised the slogan, "We're all delegates," which was an implication of their hostility to the trade union bureaucrats and the factory committees, who they argued were unnecessary and unwelcome, just potential sellouts for their struggle. Now, the unions did have a history of selling out the struggles, but the sectarian hostility of the revolutionaries to the trade unions was ultra-left because it went far beyond the attitudes of the mass of ordinary workers and their experiences, many of which had some link to the established trade unions and the Communist Party. The revolutionary left abstained from the factory committees, and rather than participating in them and trying to win workers to the idea that they couldn't just rely on the trade union bureaucrats, they too had to have their own forms of workers' organisation. But the result of this abstention from the refusal to participate in the factory committees meant that the unions had free rein to use them to increase their influence amongst workers. As union membership rose, and it did grow considerably in this period, from 31% to 6.2% from 67 to 1975. And in 1973, the Communist Party used the influence over the workers that they'd built up out of the factory committees to work alongside the right-wing government to put down workers' struggle and to actually help to introduce measures to stabilise Italian capitalism and actually isolate the revolutionaries. So in the face of this isolation and, a slowing down of workers' struggle, and as it became clearer that capitalism was much more on the offensive, it was much easier for the revolutionaries to look to some shortcut as a way forward rather than to accept the materiality and do the hard work of building an organisation in a quieter period. With elections approaching, the most obvious shortcut, it seems, to the revolutionaries was Parliament. So the revolutionary left went from a sectarian hostility to the established trade unions and Communist Party, which, Lotta Continua had earlier expressed as, in the slogan, "Who cares about bringing down the Christian democratic government? We want to smash the state." To actually looking to the magical powers of electing a left government into power in 1976. And so you think, well, is this like a huge flip for them to make? But in reality, the flip side of their substitutionist politics which meant that they had no firm commitment to seeing the activity of the working class as, you know, the central way to change society, allowed them to make this switch to reformism quite easily. After all, you know, China was an example of socialism, and there hadn't been yet any, you know, mass workers' revolution there that transformed society. So there was nothing in their politics to stop them from now seeing, you know, Parliament as the only way forward for the class struggle in Italy. Although workers could sense that the high tide of revolutionary ambitions was receding, and despite the fact that the far left were, you know, no longer going from strength to strength, from 74 onwards their paper sales began to decline, all of this sort of thing, the fact that the revolutionary groups weren't grounded in material reality, that they had no analysis of what was actually happening in capitalist society, meant that they could still hold on to the ultra-left expectations that revolution was still around the corner. So in 1974, Soffri, one of the leaders of Lotta Continua, declared that the masses are at a turning point of revolutionary significance. They predicted that the 76 elections would bring a left government to office in which the revolutionaries could form a coalition with the Communist Party. And when the elections occurred and there was a right government elected, the Christian right, you know, won the majority and was returned despite a sizable vote for the Communist Party and the fact that the revolutionary groups gained 6 parliamentary deputies themselves, the revolutionary left was pretty demoralised. Lots of people dropped out of politics altogether. And for many of those who, you know, remained involved in politics, the logic of their Stalinist politics was just to look, or conducted them towards looking for the next shortcut, and, you know, or fast track to revolution in Italy. The revolutionaries started to repudiate the working class, or, you know, well, they had started this earlier when they started to look to Parliament as the only solution in Italy, but they'd started to repudiate the working class as the only class capable of bringing about radical social change. So workers' power rejected the, quote, privileged, organised working class as being too bought off to fight for socialism anymore. The task now fell, they argued, to a broader layer of marginalised people in society, the radical students, the young unemployed youth and others, who then they now defined as part of the proletariat. So they took these people and included them in the definition of what was a worker. Lotta Continua, as well, began to see the conflict in society as no longer between the bosses and workers, but between the mass of the people and their ruling class exploiters. And this approach had nothing to do with Marxism. For socialists, the question of exactly who makes up the working class, as, you know, I hope people have been convinced of over the weekend, isn't just this abstract theoretical question. It relates to who has the actual social power to overthrow capitalism. And that power belongs solely to the organised working class as a class that produces all the wealth in society and has the ability to bring capitalism to a halt by withdrawing its labour. Stalinist politics also led a number of revolutionaries to look to the armed road of red terrorism and the Red Brigade as a viable way of bringing about revolution. They thought that, you know, through planting bombs, through kidnapping some of the heads of Italian industry, they could shock the working class out of what they perceived as this passivity and, you know, give them some sense that they should fight for revolution again. And the basis of the tragedy of red terrorism had been laid much earlier in the struggle because they looked to Mao's China and they had a real fetishization of violence and armed struggle that, you know, had led in earlier years to some of the militants from the revolutionary groups taking guns on demonstrations and doing all that sort of stuff that actually just gave the police the space to actually crack down even harder on the workers and students. Okay, but I'm going to start to conclude now. And I want to say that despite these mistakes that the revolutionary left made, I think it's important to recap some of the positive lessons that we can draw from what was still, you know, a very inspiring example of students and workers' struggle in Italy in the 60s and 70s. Because it was out of this struggle that the revolutionary left groups, previously small and, you know, not organising mainly amongst the working class, that they were able to grow by their thousands. And the reason why they were able to do this is because at least initially they had the right orientation towards seeing workers' struggle as key to getting rid of capitalism, and they went to the factories and tried to relate to it when it, you know, burst forth. When there's an explosion of mass struggle in society, the things that aren't usually possible for revolutionary left groups to achieve in the quiet times actually can become possible. The idea that we don't just have to put up with the exploitation and oppression of capitalism, nor settle for piecemeal reforms, but that another world is possible and that the working class can win it, can have a real resonance with a mass of workers who can start to see, through their experience, their own experience of struggle, their power to actually bring capitalism to a halt. And as in Italy, small revolutionary groups can grow into organisations with real roots in the working class. But the example of Italy also shows why in these situations the politics that such groups have really matter, even if they can grow irrespective of them. The revolutionary left could grow despite their Stalinist politics, but they're unable to fulfil their potential. And from having attained mass influence at the height of the workers' movement, they actually ended up turning away from the working class. Some revolutionaries took the parliamentary road and became committed to reformism. Some were drawn towards the Red Brigades and other terrorist groups. And, a large section of them just dropped out of politics altogether. Now, that isn't to say that if the groups had had better politics, that would have just been, would have meant that there would have been a revolution in Italy and that would have been the end of the story. But actually, it did mean that if they had have had some better politics, if they had had, genuine revolutionary politics, they may have been able to hold on to some of that influence that they had built in the upsurge for the future. The Italian experience shows us the importance of building an organisation on firm political foundations. We need to understand the nature of Stalinist Russia and the communist countries that weren't, so to speak, to understand the centrality of the working class to changing the world, why, and I think importantly, why there can be no shortcuts, no easier way of getting socialism. Questions that have come up in talks and discussions throughout the whole course of the weekend here at Marxism Today. And the process of building such an organisation can't just be left for when the mass strikes break out. This has to actually start in the here and now. And I want to end with a quote that I found really inspiring, and it was written by a historian who described one of the mood on one of the workers' demonstrations in the period of the upsurge. And he wrote, "As in a carnival, the demonstrations created a sense of the world being turned upside down. For a day or a morning, roles were reversed, and the workers became masters of their own time, of the city streets, the business centre, and of themselves." So, I guess, having ended with that quote, I really urge people who, may have come to the session who haven't joined Socialist Alternative yet, to please join us. And, and start to help us build an organisation with the right politics now so that next time there's an upsurge, we can, actually stand some chance of turning that sentiment that quote described, not just into, workers being in control of their lives for the first time, not just into something that's felt for a day or a morning, but actually the permanent state of affairs.